Well, hello and welcome to the second episode of The Globe and Pair, the joint podcast hosted by Glimpse from the Globe and Policy Pair. My name is Luke Phillips. I'm a senior correspondent at Glimpse from the Globe, and I am joined today by my co-host, Lina Bissokomian, the president and founder of Policy Pair. Lina, welcome.
Hi, Luke. It's great to be here.
And if you'd like to give a brief overview of what we're going to be talking about today for the audience.
Sure. So today's podcast will cover Brexit's effects on NATO and the EU, particularly relating to the UK's relationship with the US, and looking forward to potential ways that these countries can work together in the future on pressing issues such as issues in the Middle East, particularly Syria, and of course, the issue with Russia that's, you know, everlasting.
Now let's get right to the fundamental question here. So, Britain is out of the EU. Great Britain is out of the European Union. That does not mean that Great Britain is out of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization Security Alliance, but it does change the relationship Britain has with certain members of NATO, including Germany, France, and other members of the alliance. Do you foresee there being any significant, or even for that matter, any minor glitches in Britain's security relationship to NATO in the aftermath of its withdrawal from the European Union?
Well, the only thing I could see getting in the way of that is simply Brexit serving as a distraction into the internal politics of the UK, and the UK being preoccupied with understanding really where it wants to go and looking at its trajectory in the future. And of course, those are some really big questions that might lead the leaders of the country to look internally and to focus on these more pressing domestic issues and kind of put, you know, some of the foreign policy issues on the back burner. However, that being said, you know, the UK is a major player, was a major player in the EU and remains a major player, you know, in Europe, and is particularly a very important ally of the United States. So I doubt that we're going to see them withdraw in any manner that's very drastic, because it's in their interest as well to be involved.
I think you're exactly right. And I think if you look back at the history of British involvement on the European continent before the European Union was set up, they've always had an interest in the European continent being stable. Back in the days of the early 19th century and before then, there was this kind of notion that Britain was the offshore balancer of the powers of Europe. And although it no longer plays that role, because it no longer, frankly, has to play that role, there's still a kind of notion that that it's part of the European project. Even though it's formally withdrawn from the economic part of the European project, the Brits still have, I think, at the elite level, at least, a sense of Europeanness, that they're part of the same project that the Italians and the Germans and the French are part of. So I think you're exactly right. I think in the event that there is another thing like Odyssey Dawn, the intervention in Libya, or if there's ever some coordinated response to what's going on in Syria and Iraq and the Middle East as a whole, and the Europeans take a leading role in it, I think Great Britain, by definition, would have to be at the tip of the spear, just because they are one of the important leaders in Europe.
Right, of course, and we have to understand that, you know, this is a huge change for the structure of the economy and the politics of the region, and of course of the country itself, and we're risking a huge nation-building phase, so to speak. So it's understandable that both the UK and EU countries will take some time to really restructure domestic policy at home, and this will make them, you know, prone to being weaker on certain foreign policy abroad. Even though I'm sure that, you know, these countries and their leaders do understand the importance of these issues and by no means will dismiss them completely. But of course, you know, these leaders have to answer to their people, and the people are going to be looking first and foremost at domestic policy.
Now, go a little bit deeper into that that question. You said specifically when the countries of Europe, particularly Britain, start to face inward on quote unquote nation building operations within their country, they're less inclined to have a vigilant eye towards foreign policy. How do you see that playing out? Do you see the Europeans, the Brits suddenly focusing on how to redistribute income, how to reform the National Health Service, and having that be the primary political issue, while questions of how do we manage the refugee problem stagnate, and questions of how do we cooperate with the Italians and French on counterterrorism in North Africa stagnate? Is it just a question of how much attention is being paid to domestic concerns versus to international concerns, or is there a different factor at work here?
Well, I think largely speaking, it's just a demand and just how pressing some of these issues are. And of course, we know that the UK has been a key US ally in many of the pursuits that the US has had abroad. Specifically, the UK has, you know, always been working on the fringes, you know, sending out air brigades and things over Africa, as well as submarines to counter Russia in the north. So in this case, you know, what we see is the UK still does play a large role within NATO, but as we see NATO's doing some restructuring as well, you know, knowing that the UK is exiting, there have been talks where members are looking to devote more of their GDP towards defense because they're worried, having lost this major player, as to what's going to be happening in the region. And, of course, that's a sign of very big change.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, I mean, well, what sort of external pressures do you see facing Europe as a collective whole, that might even encourage further development of that? You mentioned defense spending. You mentioned Germany and France are taking more precautionary measures to take more of their security into their own hands, knowing that the Brits, who've historically been a strong figure in that system, are no longer taking as much of a role into that. How do you see this, the Europeans, quote unquote, arming themselves against and against what? What sorts of trends are we looking at in the future of Europe?
Well, I think the two main ones that, of course, everyone has on their minds is Russia and the Middle East, specifically Syria and the rise of ISIS. So looking first at Russia, I think the sanctions, which is now a bit of an outdated topic, but by no means completely irrelevant, the ability of the EU to actually hold up these sanctions without Britain, and, of course, not just the capability, but the willingness to focus on strongly enforcing these sanctions is put in question, I would say. And of course, as I said previously, Russia has a previous history of sending out submarines, particularly in the north, which the UK, you know, as an island country, has long since been protecting against, and you know, putting in place countermeasures and sending out their own submarines to you know, kind of mitigate that. So that's put in question as well. And then, of course, bringing in the Middle Eastern component, we know that the Paris attacks, which happened a while ago, but their effects are quite long-lasting and far-fetched, could really kill the cohesion and possibly, you know, more drastically result in the repeal of the Schengen Agreement. So while, you know, the UK is no longer part of the EU, it's still part of the region. So obviously that's very relevant to the country.
Right. It's interesting. So with the threats coming from both sides, you know, I would say Europe, in a way, has to deal with the same strategic threats that the United States has to deal with, only they, number one, have much less developed and centralized a defense apparatus than the United States has. And number two, those threats, rather than being across the oceans and beyond our ocean walls, are right literally on the doorstep with the terrorism and refugee issues and the instability issues in the Middle East and the kind of resurgent revanchist Russian bear clawing on the doorstep too. I mean, fundamentally, Americans worry about the same problems. We worry about the about chaos in ungoverned regions of the world, and we worry about resurgent great powers like China and Russia and Iran all across the different parts of Eurasia. But we have the luxury of, number one, having a highly coordinated defense complex in the Pentagon and State Department that manages all of North American security, basically, as well as having been separated from those threats by thousands of miles of ocean and other physical barriers. Whereas the Europeans don't have that. And aside from that, their defense system is divided between various countries that defend themselves first and Europe as a whole later. And to the extent that that NATO is an improvement on that, it's still a partnership rather than a centrally coordinated complex. Do you see this being an opportunity for there to be greater political integration, even despite Brexit, for the sake of security cooperation?
Do you mean specifically within the EU, or are you talking about the UK's collaboration with the EU?
The UK's collaboration with the EU in particular. But additionally, if you can also go on this other subject that's related to, do you think the EU, now that the UK is gone, do you think the EU will be easier to, it will be easier for the EU to centralize their operations under a single command now that they don't have to have the British vote at the same time?
Well, I don't know about easier necessarily, because, you know, you have these big players like Germany and France, notably, that have very different ideas about what's to be done. And, of course, Germany is being hit hardest with the influx of migrants as compared to the other countries. I mean, we're looking at almost a million people, if not more, at this point. So I think that it's important to consider that there are other players, though the UK was at one point a very important one. Now that it's gone, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, suddenly it's any easier to come to a consensus.
Right. Well, it's interesting because as soon as the as the votes were counted, you started hearing a lot of commentators, usually on the left side of the political spectrum, but some on the right, saying, oh, well, this is going to be the return of the security competition in Europe, and this is going to be the return of rising nationalism and nation-state-oriented foreign policy rather than internationalism-oriented foreign policy. And I get the sense, Lena, that you don't think that's the case at all. You think that it's really, I mean, whatever happens in domestic politics, the elite security apparatuses of each of the European countries are still well integrated enough and still interested in collaboration enough that there is going to be de facto collaboration at a European scale that the British will still cooperate in regardless of the decision of the British people to leave the socioeconomic union.
Well, that really depends, because we do see kind of cracks in the system and the solidarity that we've seen previously, which is great for Russia, by the way. But for example, the Schengen Agreement being the largest and most pointed example, because, you know, we always used to think of this as a specifically regional agreement, specifically for freedom of movement, very important for that, and making it easier really for Europeans to move back and forth, similar to the way we do here in the States between, you know, from state to state. So if that's no longer in place, I think that kind of puts in question in terms of socially how we perceive the EU and how people in the EU perceive the EU. And I think that kind of puts in question what's to come.
Well, I think you're right. So now, if you had to make a forecast, which way would it go? Which way do you think it would be headed? Either like greater disintegration of the Schengen Agreement and other security agreements and multilateral agreements arrived at within Europe, or do you think the integrationist system that lasts now will at the very least survive or even get stronger now that the British vote is no longer a part of the equation?
Well, you know, I think we have to consider the desire of the EU for certain mutual goals that, regardless of, you know, differences such as Germany's culture of restraint and preference for really geoeconomic thinking over geopolitical, I mean, we do see these kinds of differences from state to state. But at the end of the day, you know, they are, you know, geoproximate, and they do share borders. And so I think that there are going to be certain goals that are achievable together. And I think that regardless of preference, this is going to be a necessity.
It'll be interesting to see where it goes forward from here. Now, we're starting to run out of time, but there is one last thing that I wanted to make sure we covered before we leave here. Is Brexit possible in other European countries, and what kind of effect will that dynamic have on the security situation, not necessarily the socioeconomic situation, but the security situation of Europe as a whole? Suppose, I mean, this would never happen, but suppose the Germans, the French, the Italians, whoever, decided that Europe was no longer for them and they decided that they were going to leave, or at least lessen their commitments. Would there be the prospect still that there would be a broader security umbrella within NATO that can still provide a collective security for Europe, even in the absence of more political cooperation? Or is that Would that be under threat if the whole European project starts to unravel?
Well, I think that really, I mean, there have been some polls done on this previously because I think people were interested in this same question that you're asking, you know, after Britain left, well, why can't we do the same and do we want to? So really some of the polls are showing some pretty fearful results. Italy was up to 60% of people were saying that they would want a referendum, and slightly less than half of them said that they would actually leave the EU if they had a chance. And we're seeing that countries like France, for example, and Germany that are contributing largely to efforts within the EU and within the Schengen zone, and especially with this migrant crisis, are also similarly responding quite highly to withdrawing. But at the same time, I think that what's important to consider is that a lot of these countries are not taking that step. You know, they're saying it, but they're not doing it. And I think that might be influenced further down the road, perhaps with, you know, countries waiting to see, well, what does happen to Britain after they Brexited. So they did Brexit, but what are the effects on the country and what are the long-term effects in terms of both domestic and international policy within the UK? So I think that will also kind of sway opinion with other EU countries.
It'll be interesting to see where it goes. Now, Alina, before we wrap up here, do you have any last comments or any last things you want to remind the audience about?
Well, just to wrap up, I think the purpose of this podcast was to look at the role of the UK with cooperating within NATO and also with of the EU. And so with everything that we've said, I think I would specifically strongly recommend that the UK government develop a coherent plan with looking at EU reform, perhaps appointing a lead negotiator or somehow collaborating with the EU countries, and definitely not crossing them out necessarily, because I don't think that that would be conducive to any kind of good results. And I definitely see NATO as something that all the states convene to be important and will definitely participate in, especially because no one country could really handle these kinds of crises on its own, really, at this scale. And specifically with the U.S. saying, you know, well, we want to deal with a cohesive union. We don't want to deal with each country one-on-one. And even Obama going as far as to say, you know, if the UK withdraws, we're going to put this on the back burner as far as making an individual agreement with the UK. You know, that's how strong these sentiments are about needing to stay together and to be cohesive as much as possible. So definitely looking at ways that the EU can work together in the future, and that would be in their best interest.
Well, there we have it. Keep your sovereignty, but make sure to collaborate with everybody else too. I think it's
to a reasonable extent.
Right. Hopefully they listen to us. Hopefully they listen to you, Lena. And when you are advising governments in the near future, we will hope that they take your advice to heart. So,
well, we'll see about that.
All right. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. Thank you, Lena, for speaking with me here today. And we look forward to seeing you, listeners, again in about 2 weeks for the third episode of The Globe and Pair. Until then, have a great time and keep following World Affairs.